and it was a courtroom that had no air conditioning, and during the course of the picking the jury, a wasp or a bee came into the courtroom and went into my shirt.
I see.
And so I will now count this as one of the most unique experiences.
That's right.
As a trial lawyer. If it may please the court, my name is Anthony Griffin. I'm a lawyer out of Galveston, Texas. I have the pleasure of representing what was then the Board of Trustees for North Forest Independent School District. Mr. Toby Ross, Mr. Alan Prevost, Ms. T. Marie McCall, Alan Lemons, Sylvia Brooks Williams, Charles Taylor, Barbara Gaston. At one time, we represented the Board of Trustees plus the school district itself when the Texas Education Agency sent a letter saying that there was an intent to take over the district or to appoint a new Board of Trustees. The district, the letter was sent under the Texas Administrative Code as well as the Education Code, stating that the commission had that authority to do so, and if the district wanted to complain, the district could write a letter or the superintendent could write a letter and appear at a review. There's a procedural history surrounding the review in terms of us filing suit to stop the review after Hurricane Ike because we could not attend. The Third Court of Appeals granted that mandamus, stopped the review, and ultimately the review did take place. We appeared at that proceeding on behalf of the Board of Trustees, the district itself, because all of the Board of Trustees were not allowed to attend. When we brought this lawsuit in the district court in Houston, in the Southern District of Texas, we complained under the Voting Rights Act, as well as brought some constitutional claims in terms of what had occurred with regards to this district. And one of the things that we did in supporting the lawsuit, we attached affidavits from the board members who complained that this has only occurred three times in the history of the state of Texas. And all three times this has occurred, it's been school districts where the Board of Trustees were all black in Kendleton, which is located outside of Houston, also in a district outside of Dallas, as well as North Forest Independent School District.
Well, what happens with your argument, excuse me, in terms of frequency? If I appreciate it, the configuration of the district is such that the replacements are all African-American as well. So what does that do, you know, to your frequency argument?
I think that there are two problems with that. One of the things that's not before the court is we didn't assert voting rights. And one of the analyses on the voting rights is they replaced six or seven board members with three, a board of managers. They replaced elected officials with non-elected officials. And one of the things that we complain about is that under Texas law, these elected officials are deemed county officers. And my board members complained, and when we submitted our pleadings, they complained that, one, we had not committed a crime, two, we had not been judged incompetent, we had not done any of the things under the act that county officials are removed under.
Well, let me ask you this. You had, if I understand it, two main thrusts. One was state, one is federal. The federal one was that this process violated the Constitution and or the Voting Rights Act. In this circumstance, this procedure was pre-cleared under Section 5, so you don't have Department of Justice on your side as far as that goes. They're replaced by all African Americans. So is your strongest argument, not that you've abandoned the others, but is your strongest argument to us that this process violates Texas law and the procedure and so on and so forth? Or are you still maintaining your strongest argument is the constitutional, you know, voting rights element?
My strongest argument, and it's a little bit confusing in this sense because I remember struggling over the brief, that when I was writing the voting rights issue under the brief, I literally went in and deleted 40 pages of writing and said, no. The strongest argument is when the Supreme Court says that a component in any voting rights challenge is also a constitutional challenge. And my constitutional challenge outside of the Voting Rights Act is our strongest argument, because what we contend is that under equal protection, The only time the governmental entity has exercised this draconian measure is when race is implicated.
I hear you, but I'm still trying to figure what's your strongest threat with that argument. I mean, when I read the briefs, you know, I assumed that the replacements were not African American. So within that, I hear you three times, but haven't seen a case that says there's some number. But within the three times, if that has been the case, and if the demographics are such that it can only be that, and if the replacements are all African American, but take me further down the road on your constitutional.
Because if you view it as a voting rights case, then one would look at who your replacements were. If you view it as the removal of elected office officials, then one looks at whether, in fact, we have stated a case under 12b-6, because if the court remembers, this case gets to this court under 12b-1 and a 12b-6 motion, and under 12b-6, the facts that we assert them should be assumed to be true.
Well, the facts are being assumed as true, aren't they? I mean, there's no denial about the replacement. There's no denials or disputes about who was replaced. I hear you in terms of the argument about whether you need to be a state official or not, and that's why I frame my question. Well, what's the strong argument you're making? Is it the federal claim, i.e., violation of Section 5? Well, it seems that the Justice Department pulls the rug out on you on that if they pre-cleared it. So then if you're saying it's the constitutional argument, then, you know, how's that fitting in to say that there's a constitutional violation merely because it's only happened three times and asked the African Americans if it's a configuration where, you know, 90% of the people there are African Americans? I hear your argument, but I'm trying to see where the traction is.
Because I'm agreeing with the state. The state wrote right in their brief that I've abandoned the voting rights claim, and I have. So it's not a Section 5 analysis.
All right, then I'll cease my questions on
that. What the analysis is a constitutional analysis that these elected officials who have a property interest in their position have been placed in a circumstance where the state, the only time this measure has been exercised, has been when race is implicated.
Can you tell us, articulate for us, what relief we can grant? I'm assuming you just want injunctive relief at this point?
The relief is granted is sent back to the district court that the 12b-6 is improperly granted.
Well, but these gentlemen's terms have their terms have either expired or the election has already occurred, so we can't undo that. So what is it that you would ask us and the district court to do going forward?
I think what the relief would be is that the elected office holders that still had time on their terms are allowed to serve.
But those terms are over. Those terms have expired and a new election has occurred, I assume. That you say some were up for election in 2010. Well, that's passed. We can't unwind that clock.
I think the injunctive relief is to say that the conduct was illegal. The point becomes that the conduct doesn't occur again, and that we become more careful in terms of when we exercise these procedures. There's another issue there. The other issue is the due process component that we talked about, Justice Stewart raised, and that is, it is our contention that a Board of Trustee member does not have due process and is not allowed to participate in record review. Then the state says that they are, but if one reads the statute on its face says that the district has a right to challenge, as well as the superintendent has a right to challenge. And one of the things that we went to the district court on, the state district court on, was whether, in fact, all trustees, because they were losing their positions, have a right to challenge their removal in this record review. And what happens is they treat these elected officials as if they didn't have a property interest. Now, to answer your question, I think the answer to that question is, yes, I agree, their terms have expired. It has been long enough that their terms have expired, but I think that from a procedural standpoint, there needs to be a declaration that the conduct was illegal. And it's the same, for example, in the First Amendment case. Oftentimes, the remedy in the First Amendment case is $1 and a declaration that the conduct of the state in this circumstances under these facts was incorrect.
Did you ask,
or was unconstitutional.
Did you ask for any kind of damages?
I don't think there were. There's not an allegation of damages in the pleadings. The other problem, the reason I started off by saying, directing this court to the issue of remand, this is a 12B6. And as a 12B6, the question was, did the court improperly grant, you know, judgment, because the court treated this as a summary, judgment.
My question is it moot? Let me just address that. Is it moot?
I don't think it's moot. And the reason I don't think it's moot because there are two, in terms of procedurally, there has been an election that has taken place. The state no longer controls North Forest. Two of my clients ran for re-election and won re-election. I don't think it's moot. North Forest still is a district, and when the state took control over North Forest and left control of North Forest, the rating that the state left it with is less under published guideline. When I checked TEA website, it's rated less than it was before my clients were the Board of Trustees. So I don't think it's moot. And I was content to the court that a constitutional violation does not become moot. If there's a finding of constitutional violation, it doesn't become moot because the office holder's term has thus expired. And one other point I think that's important. Each one of these board members ran for office under the notion of cleaning the district up. Some board members had been there one term, other board members had been there two terms, and the longest serving board member had been there four terms. So we had fairly a new board. The affidavit of some of the board members in terms of giving additional facts because, you know, and I will admit to the court the pleadings may not be the most artfully drawn pleading, but the affidavits attached to the pleadings provide additional information in terms of comparing to other districts. That it gives analysis in terms of Dallas having financial problems and nothing being done to Dallas over the years in terms of removal of the board. It gives analysis in terms of another district having a person who had been convicted of a crime serving on the board, but the state taking no action against that board member or the district. And the reason that information was known because that person was an employee of North Forest. It was well publicized. North Forest found out about the conviction, fired him from his employment. It was reported in the Houston Chronicle. That board member continued to serve in another district, Ailey's, for a number of years and was never removed by the state, and no action was taken.
Can I just ask one question? Yes. Maybe I'm missing something here. I had the idea that we had a sovereign immunity problem, like maybe the threshold issue, 11th Amendment. You're suing the state. You're not suing individuals. You're suing the state and the TEA. Why is it that they're not simply immune under the 11th Amendment?
Can I?
Not on the Voting Rights Act, on the constitutional claims.
Can I address it this way, Your Honor? I went back and looked at the district court's opinion, and she never addressed sovereign immunity.
Well, but it's jurisdictional.
I understand. And when we submitted our 12B6 response, we addressed the issue of whether, in fact, we had a right and a standing to bring a lawsuit. There is existing law that when race is an issue in regards to office holders, sovereign immunity does not override the issue of discrimination or race being a protected class or suspect classification of the Equal Protection Act.
So you have authority that says that an individual individuals can sue the state directly when race is an issue, I guess would be an equal protection claim, and sovereign immunity does not obtain, is what you're saying. Now, what is your authority for that?
If I may address it in rebuttal, I need to check my brief on that issue, Your Honor. Off the top of my head, I can't tell the court at this point in time.
But I think that, I mean, I could be wrong here because I frequently am, but the biggest problem you've got in my befuddled brain is sovereign immunity. But on these claims, not on the Voting Rights Act claim, but on these claims, I don't see how you get to sue the state. I mean, a lot of these cases are brought against individuals, but this is not it's not brought against individuals. This is a case brought against the state. So
I understand, Your Honor.
Normally, those are just kind of dead in the water.
Okay. One other issue, and I will sit down. With regards to the due process claim, we also contend that with regards to due process, our clients had been denied due process in the sense that they could not participate in the record review. There is a case, and I'll sit down and regroup at this point, but I think that's, I'll reserve the remaining portion for rebuttal.
Rebuttal, okay, thank you. Mr. Clay.
Good morning, may it please the court. I'm here representing the Texas Education Agency. Your Honors, the district court properly avoided intruding into the relationship between a state and one of its created political subdivisions in this case for two reasons. The first being the jurisdictional issue that you just raised, Judge King, and the second being that the constitutional claims that are at issue on appeal here, because the Voting Rights Act's claims have not been presented here on appeal, are without substantive merit also. I'll address the sovereign immunity question first. As an agency of the state, Texas Education Agency has the same immunity as the state and cannot be sued for even injunctive relief as is sought here. The proper procedure would have been to name the individuals at issue in this case, and that was not done. As you pointed out, Judge King, that's the elephant in the room, and is not cannot be overcome. And so, it's the district court properly dismissed the case, and they did address it, albeit briefly, in their order and opinion, sort of assuming arguendo. If they did have
that well-known technique called assuming arguendo jurisdiction,
right. Exactly,
frowned upon in the best of circles.
So there was some doubt that they had that the court had jurisdiction that could exercise its jurisdiction over the constitutional claims. The court dealt with in depth the substantive aspects of the constitutional claims, and those two are without merit. I'll address the equal protection claim first. on its face, the Texas Education Code arguably distinguishes between Board of Trustee members and county officers writ large as a general group. But Board of Trustees members are not a suspect class, and therefore the district court properly reviewed the commissioner's action in the Texas Education scheme using a rational basis deferential standard. Appellants also claim that the commissioner discriminated on the basis of race, appointing a board of managers to North Forest ISD because of some discriminatory intent. But discriminatory intent has to be supported by factual allegations. The only allegation they make here to support that is the bald assertion that this has only occurred in two other districts that were primarily African-American in the state of Texas. But disparate impact, the Supreme Court has made clear that disparate impact by itself is not enough to support a claim of discriminatory intent. Cases dealing with allegations of discriminatory intent make clear that you have to look to the other direct and circumstantial evidence, and in this case, the circumstantial evidence is the record is replete with reasons that have nothing to do with race. Why the commissioner would install a board of managers in this case? North Forest ISD had suffered from a decade or longer of financial and academic troubles that are well documented in the record, And that reason alone is why the commissioner took his action to appoint the Board of Managers. The other thing I would point out is that all the procedures that are required to be given to the district and its representatives, in this case the Board of Trustees, was given to North Forest ISD. They followed the book perfectly. They were given notice at every step along the way of the proposed action of the commissioner. They were given notice of their right to seek a record review. They were then given their notice of the different ways in which the representatives could participate in the record review. The reason that all of the Board of Trustees could not be present at the record review is a aspect of Texas open meetings law, which would have made it a open meeting because a quorum of the school district would have been present, and that presents all kinds of issues. So they were given other ways to participate in the record review by being told that they could submit whatever information they wish to be considered part of the record, or being represented by counsel at the review. So in short, in sum, the state of Texas followed the book perfectly, and so both the direct evidence of academic and financial trouble and then the circumstantial evidence that the TEA and the commissioner followed all the procedural things to a T make clear that there's no discriminatory intent at all in this case, and therefore the district court properly reviewed their as-applied challenge, equal protection challenge, using a rational basis standard.
Did you argue the motion below?
No, I did not.
Do you know why the sovereign immunity argument wasn't straight up first on the agenda?
I do not. It should have been. I'll admit that. It should have been. It's jurisdictional, and it's the elephant in the room, and I think it easily resolves this case. So I can't answer why it was not the first thing out of the gate.
Because the focus below, and I'm not sure whether this is true because it's not the focus here, was on the Voting Rights Act. Was that what the dust up in the district court focused on primarily, or what?
I think that's accurate. I mean, if you look at almost all the pleadings and the court's order denying the temporary restraining order and its final opinion and order, they also, I think, lead with the voting rights claims. So I do think that was primarily the focus below. So
that's probably why he didn't really, although counsel opposite argued to the contrary about 12b-6, but really the order dismissing was a summary judgment, and that's probably because of the voting rights issues, which and the jingles and all that's very fact-based, sort of tricky handling it as a 12b-6, and based on what was filed here, it looks like the district court comfortably handle it under summary judgment rather than the narrow cabin of a 12b-6 having construed pleadings and so forth. I mean, it looks like a summary judgment type case. So,
that's right. The district court converted the motion dismissed to a motion for summary judgment. I would address the procedural due process claim. I think it's dubious that these Board of Trustees have any property interest in their elected office. The Texas Education Code in Chapter 11 gives power to the Board of Trustees, and then in Chapter 39 it limits those powers and places conditions and restrictions on those, one of those being that should certain academic and financial standards not be met, TEA and the commissioner have the right to intervene in a varied sort of way, from doing audits to appointing academic and financial conservator, and in the most extreme case, appointing a board of managers. In this case, TEA and the commissioner sort of escalated as things got worse. They started with audits, on-site audits, and attending meetings. Then they appointed academic conservator and financial conservator, and then finally the issue in this case, the appointment of a board of managers. The second thing I would point out with respect to the property interest, even if they do have a property interest in that elected office, it's not clear that they were deprived of anything. They were not removed from office or fired or they didn't lose their seat on the board. What happened is under the Texas Education Code, their powers were temporarily suspended. And so it's dubious that they were even deprived of this alleged property interest. The last point is...
Did they get paid?
They are not paid. The last point is, and appellants make a big distinction between the district itself and the Board of Trustees, but this is somewhat of a false distinction, I think, because the Board of Trustees in this case, and particularly they make that distinction arguing that the Board of Trustees and the individuals were not given their fair procedural due process. That distinction is not a real distinction because the board itself voted 7-0 to actually seek a record review. And so that distinction doesn't really make a whole lot of sense when it's the Board of Trustees who's actually making the decision to seek a record review from TEA.
What's the status now? Is it still under this temporary
no.
period, or the election period now have occurred? I assume there's a new set of elected.
Correct. In June, TEA, I think it was in June, TEA and the commissioner notified North Forest ISD that it was going to be removing the Board of Managers and holding an election to return governance back to the Board of Trustees. That election took place earlier last month. The officers who were elected to serve on the Board of Trustees were sworn in November 15th, I think. So the power is back vested in an elected Board of Trustees at this point.
All right, so the time period we're talking about was from when to November of 2010, the temporary?
It was about 2 years.
About 2 years.
Is opposing counsel seeking legal fees as a part of this lawsuit?
I think that they do request that relief, if I remember correctly, in their complaint. Obviously, there's issues with that as well when suing the state. So that's why I think sovereign immunity provides
important.
It is important. I don't know. I'd finish out my comments about the procedural due process claim. So that distinction, I think, is false, but even if it isn't, the Board of Trustees was given an opportunity to participate in the record review through, although all of them couldn't attend, some of them could have attended, so long as they didn't have a quorum. They were also allowed to participate by telephone. If they couldn't make the meeting, they were allowed to submit whatever information they wanted to be made part of the record. And lastly, they could be represented by counsel, which in fact they were. So whatever due process was due, and I don't think, as I mentioned earlier, that there's any property interest that would trigger any such process, it was surely given here in this case.
Well, I think we have your argument. Do you have anything you feel compelled to add?
I don't think so, unless you have any more questions for me. I'll sit down.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Griffin?
Yes, Your Honor. Excuse me. One of the questions that was asked related to what had we requested as relief. We requested injunctive relief in this matter. The pleadings... We did not assert damages against the state, which I think is what the sovereign immunity argument turns on. And the Seminole Tribe versus Florida case and the cases that followed it said that injunctive relief is allowable against the state. And so there's existing Fifth Circuit case law, and I don't have it in front of me, and I apologize if I request from the court to supplement. But under the 11th Amendment, we're not requesting damages from the state. What we, in fact, requested in our pleadings was injunctive relief and a declaration that the conduct was unconstitutional. There is a case of Robinson we cited in footnote 20 versus Shirley Neely in her official capacity as Commissioner of the Board of Education versus Young, and this is the Wilma Hutchings case out of Dallas. And what that case, the oath had not been taken by a board member, and the court said that person had not been taken, had not taken the oath, and could not challenge his removal under Texas law. But the court did stand for the proposition that the Board of Trustees had an authority under Texas law to challenge their removal. My Board of Trustee members had taken their oath. They were serving their terms at the time.
Who were the defendants in that case?
The defendants in that case was the Shirley Neely in her official capacity as the Commissioner of Education, which is in essence in the official capacity would be the state of Texas.
That's the only defendant?
If I remember the case correctly, yes, Your Honor. And so that Texas case, and this issue has been the question of what we do with elected officials, I think is important. And the reason it's important in this context is we filed a lawsuit which was challenged on 12b6 grounds. We did not assert damages. We avoided the 11th Amendment in that context, and we, on 12b6 grounds, it was assumed our facts were not valid. We were not allowed discovery. We were not allowed to take any depositions. We were not allowed to amend our pleadings. Now, if the Supreme Court recent decision on the Iqbal is considered, Iqbal still for the proposition you just can't search bald assertions and you have to search particularized facts, and we were more than willing to do so. I would ask the court to remand this case because 12b6 was improperly granted, and I don't think and I would ask the court to provide a supplemental letter brief on the issue of sovereign immunity since it wasn't briefed at the district court below and was not
now,
part of.
Wait a minute, but you've had an opportunity to brief sovereign immunity, haven't you? Here? Am I missing something?
I wrote the initial brief. The state raised a sovereign immunity issue in their brief. We didn't file a response brief.
Why not?
I guess I should have filed a response brief. If the court will allow me, I will give.
I don't think it's appropriate at this point. You should have responded to the state's assertion of sovereign immunity in a response brief. And if you didn't file a response brief, then to allow you to brief it now. That's what the argument was all about, was either to get your response, but to start the whole process all over again. We're here based on the assumption you've said what you had to say about sovereign immunity.
No, Your Honor, I'm not asking the court to provide a brief, to just provide the court the case that's not on the top of my head at this point in time. We are allowed to assert injunctive relief against the state on a constitutional claim, and that avoids the issue in the seminal case. And because we didn't assert damages, we don't assert damages, injunctive relief is proper against the state.
You're welcome to file a letter that gives a cite, okay?
I will do so, Your Honor.
That's it.
And that's all I was asking the court to do.
Okay.
I'm not asking to rebrief
the issue. That's fine, and if the state has a problem, you can respond. But go ahead and get it done in the next few days.
I will do so, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Okay, we call the next case for the